welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. We actually are not legally obligated to it in accordance with the Constitution. That's what I mean by that debt is fraud. And please, 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 utilize any and all tools in your spiritual tool belt that you think might actually be beneficial, especially when it comes to reclaiming the Republic. Hopefully this work can keep on moving. It is a sad point in fact that when conservative presidents win, or those perceived as conservative presidents win, then all of a sudden everybody just puts their faith in their king. So that's kind of where we're at. And welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
So, actually, before I plug away, let me just make one more plug, because I did this yesterday, and I commented that Timber Nation, who I have endorsed before, they've made great products, and they're solid wood, and they're 9 times out of 10 cheaper than what you could get somebody to do for you. And these guys will actually do custom anything, shelves, what you want in solid, you know, walnut, oak, what have you, folks. So reach out to Timber Nation, because as we spoke yesterday, they have orders open between now and Christmas. So they could be shipping and get it to you by your Christmas as a gift to yourself or what have you. Or maybe to your husband, who might want a nice audio rack or a desk or what have you. But anyway, check them out. They're a good patriot company. They got burnt down by some leftists and tried to take them out of business. So they had to. Fortunately, they had good customers that maintained their orders with them, 41 customers, and then they rebuilt. I mean, I know that the insurance kind of helped, but usually that kind of setback usually kind of decimates your business, especially a small business. And the fact that they came scratching back and they're still fighting, and they deserve our support. So anyway, folks, and they make a good product. Check it out. You get your money's worth, especially with the way things have become so inflated today. I mean, what we're paying for today is, if not double, triple. And if you look at what they're selling this stuff for, it's a steal. I'll just say that, especially with what you're looking at. I mean, these are 2-inch solid shelves in your cabinets and so forth. Check them out. That's really good stuff. Anywho, back to the Constitution. So we have been talking about taxation. We kind of have covered the 16th Amendment. And so I'm ready to kind of do any reviews or any recaps regarding the 16th Amendment, because there's no language in the 16th Amendment that allows them to utilize progressive taxation. As a matter of fact, the Constitution mandates that all taxes must be uniform, especially as it's applied to the states. Not necessarily as it's applied to other nations regarding imposts. As a matter of fact, we should actually be hitting China with heavy imposts, as well as any other hostile nation towards liberties. Anyway, got anything you want to bring up? Go ahead.
I mean, let's talk about tariffs and imposts, because that's something that Trump has talked a lot about, and he's even implied that. He was on an interview with Joe Rogan, and Joe Rogan asked him, so are you saying that we could eliminate income taxes? And he's like, sure, why not?
So we could reduce the income tax to nothing. He could actually make it go to nothing, but it wouldn't eliminate it. The only way we can eliminate it is actually through an amendment.
Sure. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
All right. So the nation was actually paid for. We used to pay our taxes, or I should say our federal government was funded solely by imposts. Because the states were always problematic in being able to pay. Now, if you look today, we actually tax our corporations directly instead of the imposts, and because it's all on income. And if we actually shifted everything to everything that, because almost everything that we buy today is being imported. And we've created these trade agreements, NAFTA, those types of things that say we're opening up free trade. In other words, we're making constitutional agreements because they do have the authority to make treaties over the trading of goods, commerce. And so we would have to actually back out of all of those trade agreements and go down the path of saying, we're no longer going to be having free trade with you. We're going to now have imposts. And so what that would do is that would actually, you know, force other countries, because they already have imposts on our goods. And they would just look at that as, oh, now you want to start taxing us? Because we're already being taxed. Now, I don't know what the imposts are on stuff coming in. But if we rely strictly on that, we would just shift our burden over to that. Now, the direct tax or the income tax could be easily phased out. Easily phased out. The real point on taxation is not how much money do we need to make, how much money do we need to make to spend what is legitimate.
Right.
So if we got rid of all of the illegitimate stuff. Now, see, here's the thing, because this is where the states really need to step in. This is not for Trump to do. This is for the states to do. And the states really need to step in and say, you know what? We need to have and maintain the Navy and the Marine Corps, because that is the constitutional requirement, and that is the constitutional entity that maintains a security for us externally. We need to maintain our militia for our internal security. But we need to stand down the Air Force and the Army and Space Force regarding, you know, those things. Shift any of those strategic responsibilities over to the Navy and literally shut down these huge, you know, Department of the Air Force, Department of the Army, and restore them back to the militias. And then what we would have to do, because this is where the federal government would really have to make up on a short end of a level of training and equipping, because all of that training and equipping needs to go to the states. Every person in the states that is going to become of the militia age based on the standard, which is 17, I think, and male and female. So, in other words, every male and female in the school system needs to actually start learning gun safety. They need to start learning tactics and techniques and those types of things that they would need to know by the time they turn 17, so that they can serve in the militia when and if necessary. That's an obligation everybody has. And as a matter of fact, this is in time with, or actually entwined, and or in meshing with the Second Amendment, as well as Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14 and 15, so that we actually start doing what we're supposed to be doing. That would be a huge shift, but the states need to actually stand up and say, this is what we got to do. We have to undo the Dick Act. We have to undo all of these things that the federal government took it upon themselves to do, because they didn't have the constitutional authority to make those types of changes. So what we have to, the other problem is, and this is where the states need to step in and go, you know, we've got a lot of people right now that are actually, they're completely dependent on the federal Social Security program. And so we need to end the federal Social Security program. When I say end it, that means that no new people join. and all the people that are in it, depending on their age and how much they've put in, all those people that are in it will actually either be bought out by a certain point in time, or they will, you know, come in at a reduced rate, you know, whatever their caps are or what have you, to where they're not putting this dramatic amount of their income, because it's 15%.
Yeah.
And so what they're going to do is they're going to now have the responsibility of funding their own retirement. And so that'll shift. So those people who aren't in it will have that. Those people who will have a kind of, I'll just say, a joint, where they're going to have a little bit of that, where they're still going to pay a little bit because they have enough time to actually invest in their own retirement. Folks, you don't need the government to put your britches on. You shouldn't need the government to actually make sure that you're taking care of yourself when you get older.
Plus, if we invested that money ourselves, we could make way more money.
Well, absolutely. And more importantly, it's up to you to make those decisions. Either you're going to do without in your autumn years and die young, or you'll suffer at your own, you know, bad decisions. You know, this forces people to take responsibility for their life end to end. And bottom line, if you really look, you know, in some of the, I believe it is in the Medical Freedom Petition, where we point out that the senators and from Montana, two senators from Montana, and the progressives, these guys were Republicans, by the way, but these progressives wanted to actually create an end-to-end entitlement system so that, you know, they basically supported and controlled your health care from cradle to grave. They actually used the term cradle to grave.
Wow.
So to do those types of things, it's well beyond the scope of our government and the powers given. These were assumed powers. And so what we have to end these things. If we can end these things, then we can actually watch that deficit spending, that unconstitutional spending, drop dramatically. What that would mean is we would be able to actually take care of the obligations in the what they have done in lying to people, and they'd actually be able to restore the system back to what it was for those who were still in it until they actually go, you know, pass away. So it'll take maybe 50 years to end it, but we have to begin at, and Milton Friedman talked about this. All you've got to do is just say, nobody comes in anymore. You don't come in. And as a matter of fact, those who just recently came in, they'll be identified and they will be paid back with an interest. They'll get a, you know, modest, you know, like a bond or T-bill, what have you, type of interest. And they will get that payment, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years. Because what ends up happening is, if you're closing out Social Security, then all of its members will slowly dwindle away. It's called attrition, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to live forever. So now you can actually watch the rolls go down and down and down and down instead of up. And as a matter of fact, Social Security is not an entitlement for disabilities. It is a retirement program that people actually, we have to restore to what it was. We shouldn't be using Social Security to pay for illegal aliens or for children that have never worked because they're disabled. I know I knew two kids that were actually, the mother was scamming Social Security where she was getting compensation because they learn how to game these things. And she had two kids that were in school, still in school, and she was getting compensation because they couldn't drink soda.
What?
Because they had a digestive condition and they couldn't drink soda and these other things because they couldn't just consume everything. It's a way they were gaming the system. And if you give people the ability, as a matter of fact, what we have found, just like in Planned Parenthood, we find these government employees, you know, because that's what they are. If they're working in Planned Parenthood, that means that the government's subsidizing them. They actually go out of their way to teach people how to game the system. Let me show you how to do this. Let me help you fill out the information so you can max out. And you would think that these people receive a kickback, a commission on, you know, bringing more and more people to the table. And I do know that with child support enforcement, every state that got engaged, every state that got engaged in child support enforcement, for every account, for every, you know, recipient and, you know, payee, which is usually the father and the mother and the child, for each of the cases that they had. So if it was family based, right? Unless you had these situations where you had different kids with different mothers, but nevertheless, for every case, because each case kind of was an umbrella, the state would receive 66%. Something like that, 66.6%. It's like 666, and they received that as a. In other words, let's say the father paid $100, the federal government would give them $66 to subsidize the cost of them administering this program. So, in other words, that $100 went from the father to the kids, and the federal government paid them. Where it was based on a huge reward. I mean, tell me what business couldn't actually do really go bonkers and, you know, just exceed profit margins if they were being subsidized by 66%.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, just think, whatever you bill people, you get on top of that 66%. So technically, you could actually start bringing your bill down.
Wow.
So that's how Child Support Enforcement Agency got so popular within the states, where the states actually started mandating and muscling in. It didn't matter whether you were an honest person and paying an honest child support.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. They mandated, they brought you in. Even though you never had arrears, they would still mandate bring you in because they wanted to handle your case so that they could get this extra compensation from the federal government. So those are the games that happen when the federal government is spending money that they don't even have the authority to do. They don't have the authority to be involved in child support.
Yeah.
There you go. So, again, that debt is fraud. It's because they're spending unlimited dollars on things that are not within their enumerated roles, responsibilities, powers, property, and so forth. So anyway, regarding tariffs, though, so tariffs have been around for a long time, and tariffs themselves is an extra tax that you place upon a country. And imposts are just standard taxes that you place upon all the goods coming in from a country. And when we look at how much money comes into America because we're buying that stuff impost free. In other words, we're giving everybody the advantage of buying that stuff. Now, when we ship stuff out, those states actually, like everything we ship to Europe, Europe has a value added tax that goes on everything that goes in there.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Right. And because the value-added tax is to pay for their health care, their Social Security, their retirement plans. That's how they fund those things. Mm-hmm. So there could easily be a shift. But bottom line, for us to get away from using income tax, we could do it, no doubt. For us to get away from it, we have to stop spending on things that are unconstitutional. If you just shift your burden from income tax to impost, and you continually spend, what you're going to find is that you'll continue to use both, because now they have a surplus. They're making more money. Now they can spend more. Now they can give you things to, you know, so that they can continually grow government.
Sounds like the state of Wyoming.
It's every state in the union, because everybody looks at that as free money, and there's no such thing as free money. No such thing. So, again, when we have a constitutional amendment that creates a direct violation of or when it's implemented in a way, because actually the Constitution itself is not being violated by that amendment. The way it is being executed is violating that. So in other words, it's not supposed to have a progressive taxation. It's supposed to be uniform. In other words, we all pay 10%, or we all pay 15%, or we all pay 20%. But regardless of what that number is, we all pay that. It must be uniform. And so when they implemented these, and that, who doesn't, if you're not making a lot of money, who doesn't want to say, yeah, tax those guys a lot more than me because they got more money? Because then you're saving yourself. In other words,
stuck to 10% or 5% or whatever, then it would be fair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when God places his tithes on people, it's 10% for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, again, we have to look at taxation not as a duty that we just have to, pay this subscription, or we're being conscripted to pay. The purpose of taxation is to pay for the cost of the necessary government, not what government wants to spend, but what they need for their forecast for the year. Of course, nobody plans on going to war. But when that happens, when they declare war, they actually have to come up with legislation that will help fund that. That's why we went into wars where they were selling T-bills or, bonds and so forth, so that people would go and buy these things, investing, and they would slowly get interest over time. Now, the 17th Amendment is, we talked about this, but it's worth at this point because it's a part of the progressive amendments. The 17th Amendment, because we never dove into this in detail, the 17th Amendment actually can be repealed. But let's read this first, and actually we got 2 minutes, so let's read that first part in red.
The Senate of the United States shall be composed of this one? Is that where we're at?
Yes.
Okay. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures.
Okay, so I already picked on the fact that whoever wrote this was an idiot because they just repeated unnecessary stuff. All they needed to do was just change the line where the state legislature is appointed, because that's all they're doing here, is giving the, moving the appointment of senators from the state legislature over to the people so that they would be elected by the people. That's all they did. They didn't change the roles and or responsibilities of the Senate within the body of the Constitution, such as did they touch their ability to authorize treaties by 2/3. No. Did they change their ability to have the responsibility of overseeing and providing advice and consent to executive branches as well as Supreme Court appointments and so forth? No. The only thing this did was it changed how senators were to be appointed. Did it change? And this is where we dove into this. Did it change Article 5 and the equal suffrage of the Senate, or I should say the equal suffrage of the state in the Senate? Now, when we read Article 5, and I'll go to that, when we read Article 5, it says this, that no state shall lose, or actually, provided that no amendment which shall be made, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, when they say state, that is very specific. It's not the state of the people. It is the state government. So hitting a break, and by doing so, we're going to kind of have to come back to this. But folks, I want you to think, when the Constitution was framed, there was suffrage that was offered and was secured for the state legislature because they were the sovereigns of the state. They had this representation to affect treaties and appointments and so forth. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so to be clear, when they say state, this is speaking of the state legislature. When we talk about suffrage, when we talk about our form of Republican form of government, they didn't get rid of the Senate and its responsibility to ensure that these matters that were of the state interest, these treaties that were coming, and most people don't care about treaties. Most people don't care about maybe the appointments of executives and so forth. The Senate and the state legislature have this symbiotic link that they are to basically, tune in their senators so that they represent them in that Senate. Now, today, because the 17th Amendment changed it, everybody thinks that the Senate now responds and reports back to the people, and they're giving the people suffrage as their representatives. But that's not the part that was changed. Only the appointment part. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when we look at the 17th Amendment, it's clear that the 17th Amendment did not grant the Senate, this new formed Senate, or I should say this new change to the appointment of the Senate, it didn't grant them to ignore the state legislature. They still had that responsibility. It did not touch Article 5. It only touched Article 1, the appointment part. That's it. So when, and the whole point of the second part, when vacancies happen, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's just, that only changes because of the appointment part. In other words, the state legislature doesn't replace, you know, by appointing a new senator. It goes to the executive, and then the governor makes sure that there's, you know, in the next election, they account for replacing that senator or, you know, in, because he may make a temporary replacement until that election. That's what the second part is. And so, bottom line, this amendment shall not be so construed to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid part of the Constitution. There's no language there whatsoever that says that the Senate will no longer be responsible for those things, the enumerated in the Constitution, for all these other things. It only changed how they were appointed.
Okay.
Okay, so when the state, and this is what we, you know, we have to start driving this. We have to start driving this into our counties so that the counties actually get the state legislature to hold the Senate accountable. In other words, we actually have to start pushing this issue so that the state legislature actually calls up whoever's responsible, or they have a meeting and they appoint a chair to be the liaison for this senator and another chair for the other senator, and they call and they drive their demands into those Senate seats. Those are their seats.
Hmm.
Even though they're being appointed by an election, those seats still belong to, and those votes still belong to, the state legislature. As we spoke in the last Thursday, we talked about this importance of suffrage, that, you know, when we talk about getting our legislature or our Congress or even our county commissioners to doing something, we talked about calling up and doing one-on-one. Yeah, one person can easily call and say, you got to do this. But when that person represents 30,000 people, or today a representative, almost a million, if you look at the state and how many people that are electing that senator, that's millions and millions of people? No. It still is those millions of people as represented in the body whole of the state legislature. Yeah, it still goes over all the people, but it's the state legislature who is directing them. And that's how it's supposed to be. And the state legislature is letting them get off the hook. So we need to actually get our state legislature attuned to forcing these types of things to happen, so that we get our suffrage, or I should say the state legislature gets their suffrage. And this is so important because Schumer was literally trying to redesign the bench and all of these other things by converting the Senate into a basic democracy. Let's not forget what the heck he was doing. And actually, this is where the state legislature needs to actually step in and go, you know, all of these changes that you've made, you've ignored us in coming back to us and saying, you know, we want to break this 60 vote rule. That's not good enough. Not anymore. You have to reinstitute the 60. All of these things you did to break, you never got our permission to do that. We want you to get back to those old standards and reinvoke that threshold. And as the state legislatures basically tell their senators to do that, and if they're not convinced that the senator's doing their job and carrying their weight and getting it done, pull them back. Have them removed. And what would the grounds of their removal be? Article 5. That no state shall lose its equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. And if you're not giving us suffrage, and if you're not doing our bidding, then we're pulling you back. Because they never touched Article 5.
Right.
Okay. I know it seems like I'm just dragging a dead horse through the mud. That's one way of, cleaning up the ditch, but more importantly, it's one way to try to help drive the message so that people start getting this. Because if you can articulate this to your state legislature, then all of a sudden you're actually empowering them to exercise their suffrage or their control over that suffrage, more importantly. Okay, so we covered the 16th and the 17th Amendments now. Now, the next amendment is the 18th Amendment regarding the manufacturing and the selling of intoxicating liquors. So let's go ahead and read this, because what ended up happening from the federal government is they took a lot of license and latitude with this. So go ahead.
After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within, the importation thereof into, or the exportation thereof from the United States, and all territory subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited.
Okay, so this is the Prohibition Amendment. All it's doing is saying that you can no longer manufacture or sell intoxicating liquors. Now, this isn't beer and wine. This is just liquors. And so they're now going to be prohibited 1 year after ratification. So everybody gets their buzz on for the next year. And then at the end of that year, it's done. Then it says the Congress and the several states shall have concurrent power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Right? So what does that mean? There's that language again. What does that mean? Legislation. It's law. In other words, Congress shall be able to make a law for the concurrent power, or I should say, to enforce this. So when it comes down to the federal enforcement entity, what is that? Did it tell them that they could make an enforcement entity? They could create a standing army?
No.
No. The Constitution already has an identified enforcement entity. Does this actually take away the no standing army shall be used?
No.
Okay. So in other words, all this does is it's kind of redundant or stating the obvious that both, and because they talk about a concurrent power, that the state legislature, as well as Congress, shall have the concurrent power to be able to enforce this by legislation. So they can create the laws of how they want to enforce this. Those laws from the federal government would then go to the states, to the militias, and to the maybe the federal marshals to ensure that the states are going to execute these using the militia appropriately, if necessary. Because bottom line, the militia doesn't get involved in the enforcement of any federal law until when? That's a question. When is it that they can actually engage the militia? It's in Article 1, Section 8. Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia. So they actually have to call forth and federalize the militia to execute the laws. Because, you see, the militia is not a standing army. They can only call them forth, you know, and they say, oh, well, we need to enforce this all. Why do they need to enforce it all the time? Why would they need to go after the production of liquor all the time when actually it says there's concurrent power? Let the state do most of the enforcement. If you need to use the militia, you already have access to the militia. Use it. If it gets out of hand and we need other states to go into your state because it's out of hand, then we will federalize the militia to assist you.
Yeah, sometimes it gets confusing going back and forth between the state.
I understand.
Yes, yeah, and then the federal government that's going to.
I completely understand, and so that's. I don't expect the right answers. As a matter of fact, 9 times out of 10, I kind of expect people to go, I don't know. It's just because the formula, because that's all it is a formula. If all of a sudden there's a requirement to execute the law, the state should be executing the law. If the state is incapable of executing the law, then, or if it, so it, let's start at this from the micro to the macro. So you've got a county, and there's a town that is actually within that county that is a major hub of manufacturing hard liquor, whiskey, bourbon in Kentucky. And, right? I mean, they're known for their bourbon. So, you know, these guys didn't want to just give up their trade and give up this job. You know, how dare they, you know, do this to them? So they have to start making it, you know, after hours or what have you. And they have to actually create an underground, you know, railroad or this, you know, this black market where they can actually, you know, produce and sell their liquor, because that's what ended up happening. That's exactly what happened. They created a black market where they basically did it, you know, under the, you know, auspices of not doing it so that the government wouldn't find out, so that they could still get their buzz on. And so what happened was that they started creating this new system of manufacturing and distribution that was not visible, supposedly, to the federal government and the state government. And as they started getting caught, because, you know, it started growing and growing, and they started realizing that there were these private clubs where, you know, you had to be a member to go in, and the police just couldn't walk right in. And so they could, you know, you have to knock and then, okay, come on in. Everybody flushed down their drinks or whatever and go. And all they had was beer and wine. And, oh, okay, everything's legit, you know. So they had to hide. They had to hide this consumption, production, distribution. And bottom line, this was to be done or executed by the state. The federal government wasn't to create this huge army. There was no authorization for them to create the FBI.
Right.
And this is when the FBI was created.
Really?
Yes. Technically, the FBI was being created, and it was, I think it goes back to 1906. Google it. Look it up.
I will.
So, while you're Googling it, I'll just lay it out this way. That as the FBI was created, they're trying to find a good way to implement it and use it. They realized that they could utilize the FBI, but they needed to do something more, and they created the ATF.
So it's 1908.
And so when was this amendment? This was a few years later. But they said, hey, we have this institution over here that's been really good. And this basically put a surge of money in growing the FBI. It's the same thing with the ATF. Look up the ATF. When did the ATF start regulating alcohol and tobacco and firearms? Now, I'm going to say that because the Dick Act was 1903, when it came down to firearms, the federal government started pulling those things back under their... They started controlling these things unconstitutionally, and the Dick Act was unconstitutional because they literally realigned the militia out from underneath the states. And so when was the ATF formed?
Well, it says it was established in its modern form in 1972. Uh-huh. Its origins trace back further to the Prohibition era.
Uh-huh.
Initially, it was part of the Department of Treasury as a small unit within the IRS.
Right. So it was actually the Treasury doing it, and it was just an office of interfacing back going all the way back to the whiskey tax.
Yeah, it's created to enforce tax laws related to alcohol and later firearms and tobacco.
In other words, and not only that, but to create regulations and controls. So when we look at any enforcement agency and its origins, the question is, why does the federal government have a standing army doing that when the Constitution requires that the federal government use the militia to execute the laws? I mean, even Hamilton and Washington got that right. They called forth the militia to execute the laws of the whiskey tax or the distilled liquor tax. So, when we read the final one, go ahead and read section 3 now.
Hold on, let me get back. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of the several states as provided in the Constitution within 7 years from the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress.
Okay, so what does that mean? I mean, so that's a lot of language there to basically say something. What are they really saying? I mean, that's three lines. There's a lot of words there. What the heck are they saying?
It seems to me that it'll expire in 7 years.
There you go. Okay, so out of those 45 words, basically, if this is not ratified within 7 years, it is dead. But they didn't say it that way. And as a matter of fact, let's go to...
How can they even carry it out if it hasn't been ratified?
Okay, so... well, they don't. As a matter of fact, they started off in the very first section as saying that when this is ratified, it will go into effect 1 year after its ratification, right?
Right.
Okay. So if you go to the inoperative amendments regarding, I think this is the Equal Rights Amendment. And if you read Section 4, it's the second inoperative amendment. If you go to the very bottom of the color-coded Constitution, and folks, you can see all of these amendments that have never been passed, you know, that were out there, that actually died or, if you know, never been fully ratified. But if you look at this and you actually see what they did in this, they said, this article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission. In other words, they were creating an expiration date, and this was the Equal Rights Amendment. So most people thought that, you know, that was the first time. Well, actually, no. When you look at the amendment that we were just talking about, the 18th?
Mm-hmm.
That they gave them 7 years as well, but nobody even blinked at it because it was proposed in 1917 and ratified in 2 years. I mean, this was when the base group of Mothers Against Drunkenness, you know, actually converted. And technically, this was a really dangerous amendment, because the federal government actually finally got a little bit of control over a very specific behavior of the people. The federal government was never to have these types of powers, never. The bottom line is that what they ended up doing was they ended up creating an ability to start reaching, because, you know, look at how many laws that they now have that the FBI comes in and, you know, arrests you, you know, for drugs, kidnapping. I mean, these are criminal laws, but why is it that the federal government is actually executing these federal crimes when they don't have the enumeration over those crimes? I mean, the only crimes that they actually have that they should actually be enforcing is treason and counterfeiting. And so we got lots of people out there that are committing treason. And if the FBI was doing that and actually going after, when I say treason, not treason against the government, treason against the Constitution. You have a right to say, I don't like what Biden's been doing. I don't like what this liberal Congress is doing. They're violating. We have every right to hold them accountable and call them out for all of their violations. It's called the right to petition for the redress of grievances. We have these rights. And so this is how we keep our government in check. Now, the reality is, folks, government never wants to be held accountable. They're like kids. Well, come on, we're making it up as we go along. Give us some latitude here. Okay, so the next amendment that we could talk about. But bottom line, we know that this was unratified and or undone. When was it? The 21st Amendment? Yeah, the 18th article. So this was proposed and unratified the same year. In other words, they realized that this was a huge mistake. And it's ironic that they did this when America was in the midst of its depression. In other words, hey, come on, give us something to have, you know, to give us, you know, get us through the night in these hard times.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, what the amendments that I think, and the one amendment, because we already covered the 1803 amendment from Thomas Jefferson regarding Indian territory. The one or granting land at any form of land to the Indians. So what I'd like to do is I would actually like to go into the proposed amendment in 1926. And as a matter of fact, it is right after the 19th Amendment. And the 19th Amendment is where the right shall not be abridged for any U.S. citizen for voting regarding sex. In other words, this was the Women's Right Amendment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... with that 19th Amendment, when you look at the next one, unratified, you see that? proposed in 1926, unratified.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go ahead and read this one. Section 1.
The Congress shall have power to limit, regulate, and prohibit the labor of persons under 18 years of age.
Okay. So, Congress was asking the states. This was Calvin Coolidge's amendment. Calvin Coolidge was a huge union man. He loved collective labor. He thought that that was the way forward for America, believe it or not. Now, most people think that he was a conservative. He wasn't. He was a progressive. He was a self-acclaimed progressive. And I think that this gets glossed over. What's the author that did Calvin Coolidge? Amity Shells, something like that. And so he himself considered himself a progressive. And so after he served, and he ended up not running for re-election, he just basically let his term go out when his son died. When his son died, it was just like he lost his life. Mm-hmm. And so he was just became, you know, withdrawn, and it just, everything it took for him to just get up every day. And it took a long time for him to recover. And it wasn't until the 30s when he seemed to be recovering. And it was right about this time, or I should say right around 1934, I think, when Hoover got elected and they wanted to actually run a candidate against Hoover to replace Hoover, because Hoover was a Democrat. But Hoover had implemented so many progressive policies that they, when they came to Calvin, and this is actually included, I think, in Amity Shell's book, that when Coolidge was asked, hey, we want you to come in and, you know, and challenge and hopefully become president instead of Hoover, because we definitely don't want FDR to do this. And so Coolidge basically looked and he says, you know, I'm progressive, but I'm not that progressive. I don't understand that government. Because, see, here, Coolidge was actually trying to do the right thing by amending the Constitution to give the federal government the ability to regulate labor. Now, what do we learn from this proposed amendment? This is kind of the obvious. What is an amendment for? An amendment is to delegate or to basically formally authorize the government a power.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is a power they don't have.
Right.
Okay. This is an amendment that they sought to obtain this power. So therefore, because this amendment was never ratified, then they can't have this power.
Mm-hmm.
But do they? Are they regulating labor?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And they were only looking to regulate labor of children. That's all. So, folks, we'll try to wrap up on this and a couple of other amendments that, you know, on the elections and so forth. But for the most part, like I told you last week, we should be wrapping up this week on all the Constitution and diving into some new content. Starting off with the resolutions, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.